Welcome to the official companion podcast series to the Showmax original Catch Me a Killer. If you're coming across this companion podcast for the first time, this is the fourth installment and covers Catch Me a Killer episode 5. If you haven't listened to the other companion pods, or heaven forbid, started watching the Showmax original Catch Me a Killer yet, you need to do that first and come back. If you're all caught up and ready to go, let's do it. I covered the case that features in episode 5 of Catch Me a Killer relatively recently on the True Crime South Africa feed. Christopher Mhlengwa Zikode was also known as the Donnybrook serial killer. There's quite a few really interesting elements of this case, which we don't often see featuring in serial murders. One aspect of that is we saw this series occurring against the backdrop of an intense period of faction fighting in our country, which the killer actually weaponized to hide his crimes, and the SAPS actually became unintentionally complicit in helping him to do. More on that in the full coverage I did of the case, which I'll link in the show notes. But the other aspect of this case, which I found fascinating, was Zikode's mother's reaction to finding out that her son was a serial killer. So in this companion pod, I'm going to give you a summary of the facts of the case, and then I think we can explore what it's like to be the parent of a serial killer. KwaZulu-Natal is renowned for its scenic beauty, covering an area similar in size to Portugal. It comprises three distinct geographical regions, the coastal lowlands, the Midlands, and the mountainous areas of the Drakensberg and Lebombo Mountains. The Tugela River, the province's largest, flows through its center. Despite its natural beauty and warm, welcoming people, KwaZulu-Natal has a troubled history marked by violence, particularly in the 1980s and 1990s, which was known as faction fighting. The violence was partly fueled by the apartheid government, leading to thousands of deaths and a community in survival mode. Donnybrook, a settlement near Durban, experienced severe violence during the same period, which left that community in fear and isolation. Among the attacks perpetrated by faction fighters, a serial killer began to operate, and his crimes would be easily masked by the political turmoil and deep fear that already ran through the community. On the 13th of April, 1995, Thandi Gwala was assaulted and her friend was shot. 6 days later, Sibongile Mikize and her boyfriend were killed in their home, with the community too afraid to intervene when they heard the gunshots. The police initially labelled these murders as faction fighting incidents, despite the victims having no connection to the movements. The cases were poorly investigated, with victims not receiving proper autopsies and bullets being left in the bodies. A series of murders and rapes followed, with victims often being mutilated and sexually assaulted. The community suspected a serial predator, leading to misguided vigilante justice, which failed to stop the attacks, of course, but did result in the deaths of 3 innocent men. Mhlengwa Zikode, a 30-year-old man, was eventually arrested for an attack on Beauty Zulu. Despite the community's suspicions, Zikode was initially charged only for the attack on Beauty. The police, however, began to see similarities in modus operandi of the crimes, leading to Zikode's arrest for multiple murders and rapes. Zikode's background revealed a troubled childhood, with his family moving frequently to avoid violence. He was the youngest of 5 children, with his disabled father having passed away when Zikode was 10. Zikode was sent to live with his grandmother at 13, where he struggled with social interactions and was expelled from school. His life took a turn toward faction fighting, which he saw as a means to gain power. The investigation into Zikode's crimes revealed a pattern of violence and sexual assault that had gone unnoticed by the police. Despite the community's efforts to bring justice, the violence had continued. Mhlengwa Zikode, who would become known as the Donnybrook serial killer, terrorized the rural South African town of Donnybrook from 1993 to 1995. His crimes included murder, rape, attempted murder, and indecent assault, with a total of 18 murders and 10 rapes having been committed. Zikode's modus operandi involved breaking into houses, shooting male family members, and then raping female victims, sometimes for hours, before killing them. He also targeted women on footpaths, ambushing them and dragging them off to be raped and killed. He was finally convicted on 21 charges, including 8 murders, 5 rapes, 5 attempted murders, and 1 indecent assault. Zikode was sentenced on the 7th of January 1997 to 5 life sentences. The High Court judge who sentenced him noted Zikode's contemptible attitude toward women. Zikode's crimes were characterized by a lack of regard for human life, but his actions seemed rational and acceptable in his mind, with no remorse. Despite his conviction, Zikode refused to take responsibility for his actions, blaming his older sister and mother for his behavior. Zikode's relationship with his mother was quite complex. The school of psychology that Mickey Pistorius works with put significant focus on the relationship with the mother in the development of abnormal psychology. Zikode's father passed away when he was 10 years old, and he'd been cared for predominantly by his older sister during his childhood. His mother was present in the home, but his sister filled the mother role. He claims that after his father passed away, his sister left the family home without telling him, and he never saw her again. Pistorius says that he would have experienced this as a significant sense of abandonment from his mother figure. During his trial, Zikode said that he felt his mother and sister should apologize for the murders and rapes because, according to him, it was their job to teach him how to interact with women, and they'd failed to do so. Pistorius felt that in his crimes, the male victims had represented his father, who, due to his disability, in Zikode's mind, held no power, so he'd quickly disposed of them. And the female victims represented his sister, who had been his mother figure, toward whom he directed the majority of his violence and humiliation. Zikode's mother also unknowingly played a pivotal role in parts of his offending. While she'd been collecting firewood one day, she'd found a stack of pornographic magazines and taken them home to her teenage son. He'd stuck posters from those magazines on the wall next to his bed. Some of Zikode's victims were found posed in similar ways to the women in these posters. In what would become almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, once Zikode's mother found out that her son had committed all of these horrendous crimes, she completely disowned him. The rejection of the motherly figure he claimed to be acting out in his murders was exactly what he got after committing his crimes. Zikode and his family lived among the community he hunted in, and this only added an additional layer of trauma and pain to the entire situation. He hadn't been an outsider. He'd been one of them. A young man they'd watched grow up and trusted by virtue of him and his family being community members. This fact very likely played into Zacorde's mother's reaction to his crimes and her choice to reject him. Whether or not the parents of killers or serial killers decide to continue supporting their children really comes down to each individual situation. Many do continue to support and stand by their children. Others decide the burden is far too heavy to carry. While we often think about the impact of the family members of victims in cases like this, and rightly so, we don't usually think about how the parents and family members of the offender are impacted. In fact, we sometimes blame them and force them into hiding because once their offspring is behind bars, they are the only ones left to direct our anger at. Although childhood trauma can and does impact criminality, it is by far not the only contributor. And to blame a mother or father directly for their child's crimes, unless they had direct knowledge and did not act, of course, is utterly unfair. When I wrote my first book, Samurai Sword Murder, I got some deeper insight into what happens when your son becomes a murderer and how it impacts the offender's family. And let me tell you, that experience changed how I approach true crime cases. Once you've seen the other side of the coin, it's very difficult to unsee it. Zacorde's mother did not raise a serial killer. She raised a young man who chose to be a serial killer. And the more we understand about the weight that nature and nurture play in developing criminals, the more we have to face the fact that offenders' families cannot be blamed for their offending. We hardly ever hear about the other side of this because offenders' families so often go so deep underground. Even if they do choose to maintain contact with their incarcerated son or daughter, there's far too high a risk in publicly speaking about the difficulties they face. So we never really get to know what it feels like to go to sleep one night with a whole array of dreams and hopes for your child's future, and to wake up the next morning to a world where they are now a murderer and nothing more than a monster in the eyes of the public and your community. Zacorde's mother chose to reject him, to disown and cut off all contact with him. Although we don't know her reasons for doing so, it's very likely she may have had to do this just to live a normal life within her community. Although we all might think we could never stand by our children if they committed such heinous crimes, and some parents do simply refuse to believe their son or daughter is guilty, when you're in a situation like this, as hard as it is, many parents say they can't turn their back on their child. They may have done horrendous things, they say, but they are still their children. And maintaining contact and supporting them through their prison time doesn't necessarily mean they condone their acts. Although offenders' families usually keep themselves under the radar, one woman, the mother of a school shooter in the US, did choose to share her story, and it was incredibly revealing. Sue Klebold is the mother of Dylan Klebold, who was one of two offenders who committed what has become known as the Columbine School Massacre in 1999. Dylan and his friend Eric Harris murdered 12 of their fellow schoolmates and one teacher before taking their own lives. Years later, Sue Klebold chose to break her silence and write a book and then do several talks about her experience. She did so not for sympathy. She understood that her pain was in no way equal to those of the victims' families, but rather in an attempt to prevent future incidents. In so many of these cases, we hear people ask, how could the killer's family not have known? And in her books and talks, Sue explains how, despite being a loving mother with what she thought was a great relationship with her son, she had no idea he was suicidal and planning mass murder. No idea at all. In the aftermath, she and her family became pariahs in their community. She couldn't find anyone who would help her bury her son. People swore and spat at her in the street. She, her husband, and older son had to flee their house with their pets in the hours after the massacre because police warned them they couldn't guarantee their safety. And in her book, Sue admits that although she's not in any way glad her son took his life, she also doesn't know what her life would have looked like if he had lived. She's unsure whether she would have been strong enough to visit him in prison every day for the rest of her life. And perhaps in this woman's experience, so completely separate and different from the lived experience of Zikode's mother, we can understand why she chose to walk away. A mother's love can overcome many things, but perhaps seeing the eyes of her son's victims reflected back in his own every time she visited him was simply a bridge too far. And that is our deep dive into the killer behind episode 5 of Showmax's original Catch Me a Killer. I'll be back soon for another more in-depth look into the scary phantoms our heroine, Mickey Pistorius, is tracking in episode 6.